Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Podcast on WVIK Public Radio. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of Eastern Iowa and Northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. And, you know, since I started this show and podcast back in 2014, first in Burlington, Iowa, down the river on AM radio, and then since 2020 here on WVIK, I've had a front row seat to the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican Party and as president twice. And I've also been able to witness the Democrats' response, electing Joe Biden in 2020, but losing in 24. And it's a big part of this. It's been the remarkable political realignment of some members of the working class, a traditional important part of the Democratic base, going to the Republican Party. Our region here is heavily working class, and so I think it's an important topic to re-engage with quite a bit, which is why I've done that. It's been one of the major focuses of this show since we started. We're going to continue that today with a very interesting report that was recently done, and I'm very fortunate to have one of the co-authors with me today. She's Claire Ainslie, and she's got a very interesting background of interest to our listeners. She actually worked in Britain for Keir Starmer, who's now the prime minister. And as you know, maybe aware, the Labour Party there was out of power, lost working class voters, but was able to get some back. And she had a front row seat to that as a the executive director of policy for Prime Minister Starmer. So she's now working some here in the United States with the Progressive Policy Institute. She's the director of the project on center-left renewal. She's co-authored this report we want to talk about today. It's called Build Back Belief, Why Voters Around the World Lost Faith in Government and How to Win It Back. She's also the author of a book called The New Working Class, How to Win Hearts, Minds, and Votes. Sorry for that long introduction. Claire, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Very interesting background and very appropriate here to what's going on in our country. But I'm going to go right at the title. You talk to a lot of working class voters, elected officials, et cetera. I'm very interested in this. Why did people lose faith in government? Is that kind of the key for Democrats in the United States to unlocking this mystery, getting working class voters back?
Yeah, I think it is. So these were groups that were conducted by Deborah Mattinson and myself. Deborah, you've had on the podcast. She was director of strategy for Keir Starmer whilst I was director of policy. And we both had a long-standing interest in working class voters, not just traditional working class, but kind of what you'd count as sort of today's sort of working, or you might maybe call them middle class in parts of America. And what really came from the groups that we did, and we did these groups in the US, in the UK, Australia, and Germany. And we went in trying to find out why they had either voted out centre-left governments recently or voted them back in. And I think what was just so stark was that in the groups that we did, just voters, and these were all non-college educated, working class voters, just this kind of lack of trust in politicians, which we know, but also starting to feel that kind of government wasn't really on their side, couldn't really be trusted to work for them. And that wasn't just a sentiment that we heard in the US, which has probably had some more historic kind of skepticism of big government. But we also heard it in Germany. You know, the Germans are famous for their efficient public services and so on. And we really sort of felt that this was why we titled the whole report Build Back Belief, because it wasn't just that politicians weren't believed, it was that the government itself wasn't believed to be capable or competent enough anymore to deliver for ordinary people. And we think that's really at the center of some of the problems, but also perhaps the way back for the center left.
I talk about this with my students. I teach part-time, and they've grown up in an era totally different from me. I was able to grow up in an era of John Kennedy and great idealism, belief in the power of government to change things. And if you think about young people in the last 20 years, we've had the failed Iraq war, we've had the Great Recession, which I don't know that we ever fully recovered from, and other elements where our government just hasn't been working well, it seems like, and seems like it favors the interests of the wealthy over the working class. One of the things I thought was very interesting in this was the profile of the working class voter. You know, if you asked our listeners right now, close your eyes and imagine what you think a working class voter is, they might say somebody in a factory, like at John Deere in the Quad Cities or something like that. You kind of challenge that a little bit and have a different profile.
We do, and I think partly politics has sort of made the mistake of, I think, profiling working class voters based on quite a traditional stereotype of what it means to be working class. And obviously, our economies have undergone enormous changes over the last 30 or 40 years. So whereas in Britain, you might have imagined a working class voter as probably male, ethnically white, probably working in manufacturing or adjacent to. Actually, today's working class voter is far more likely to be female, working in the service industry, and also located in the towns and cities of the country. So, not just this sort of geographically specific area that was termed the Red Wall over here. So, part of our work has been to kind of really modernize and update that version because just because the traditional working class has got smaller doesn't mean a new working class hasn't replaced it, really. Which is really where the political battleground has certainly been in British politics for the last few years and the foreseeable future.
You talk in the report about the missing middle. Can you kind of describe that and what characteristics are associated with it?
Yeah, so this is not one for sort of sociological purists who will probably want to could, you know, there's a whole other podcast on picking over exact definitions of how you define class, but what we heard was, and what we reflected in this phrase, missing middle, is this sense of voters who feel that they are not really wealthy, but they're not really poor either, but they just feel like they are just struggling to do what used to be something that could afford them a decent standard of living. So they're all working by and large. Usually working in jobs that were not necessarily low paid, but kind of maybe low to middle. But feeling that was not life was not affordable, and therefore they felt that this missing middle that they were missing from politics, and they were holding up the economy, but they felt that this sort of middle class, as you might call it in America, is just shrinking, and that nobody is really speaking for them anymore. So they didn't particularly. We all spoke to swing voters as well. We didn't pe speak to people who were like diehard MAGA or diehard Democrat. These are people that had voted Democrat in the past but hadn't done so at the last election. And they just felt like no one was really standing up for them. They didn't really feel like Trump was either, but they did feel like he was going to shake things up at least.
Issues. I mean, affordability is obviously the key issue right now, and it has been for the past several years. Trump's rise predated the affordability issue. But what are they looking for from government that they're finding they can't trust government to provide?
What they were looking for was really, I didn't feel anything too unreasonable. They just were looking for kind of signs that the government were on their side. So voters would sometimes in quite a complimentary way in Britain refer to the Australian Labor government, and it got over all the way from there to here that Anthony Albanese, their Labor Prime Minister, for example, had given voters a rebate on their energy at the peak of the energy crisis. And then their forward offer for the election was about introducing grants for solar panels. They had also done a ban on social media for under 16s. And for the parents in our groups, they were kind of bewildered why government couldn't do something which they thought was so obviously on the side of on parents. So really what they were looking for was a total focus on their pressure, which is all on costs and affordability, and really significant symbols that showed that that government was on their side. So, yeah, whether it was a rebate, I mean, most of the time when you look at what voters actually want, they are less interested in kind of what we'd call cash transfers, but they are more interested in things that allow them to get on and do well. So, help to start a business, skills always comes up as a huge area where people want affordable ways to earn and learn. So they definitely are interested in self-help more than kind of government help. But at this point, the question for centre-left parties is what is it that they can do that shows they understand the cost issue and are going to help people to get on?
Very interesting. Who are hero voters? You described that, and for our listeners out there, this is something, a term that you used in the Starmer victory, and it might have applications over here too.
I've missed which term.
Oh, the hero voters.
Oh, the hero voter. Sorry, just the audio just cut out for me. Yeah,
Oh,
so
that's okay.
this was a development from Deborah when she was a director of strategy, was profiling. So there were a couple of really important things. The first was a big strategic decision that the voters that Labour needed were what we would call this more kind of modern working class. So it wasn't about stacking up votes as we were doing in the urban liberal areas amongst in sort of populations that were kind of already in agreement. It just meant that we were then going up in the polls, but we weren't actually going to win a parliamentary majority because we weren't shifting. The vast majority of places in the UK are kind of, yeah, suburbs, towns, where maybe more provincial England, Wales, Scotland, that aren't these big urban centres. So the big strategic decision was we would go for what they were called by the party kind of blue collar places, but you know they were recognizable to any American you know listening to this podcast of places that are not necessarily deindustrialized, but they're places that are sometimes their high street might be struggling a bit, not very very close to being part of a big city. But that was a big decision to focus on voters in those places, swing voters. And then to really make sure that this was then threaded all the way through the Labour Party's operations, Deborah created this profile of a hero voter. And it had a couple of purposes. And one of the purposes was so that we understood exactly who it was we were talking about. It was personalised. These were real people. We'd go out onto the streets because we would be campaigning, going door to door. And you would go onto your app to tell you who to door to knock on. And it would say, you know, Debbie, hero voter at number 43. So it was really sort of saying to our activists, these were hero voters. But it had the other purpose, as well as targeting, of paying respect to these voters, because there is this sense that, particularly since the Brexit referendum, that the social divide between people in the country had got bigger and bigger. And to some extent, there was a distancing, and it was a distancing, I would say, from a kind of more urban liberal elite, sometimes kind of looking down their noses somewhat at those in the towns and villages and suburbs. And that was something that is, you know, in no way is ever going to kind of win a party the majority of people. So hero voters was a way that Deborah created of paying some respect to those voters that was overdue.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Claire Ainslie, who's the co-author of a new report called Build Back Belief: Why Voters Around the World Lost Faith in Government and How to Win It Back. She's the director of the project on center-left renewal for Progressive Policy Institute. We've been talking a little bit about this report and some of the key findings in it. I guess to me, the 800-pound gorilla for the Democrats, and I hear this myself here. I live in an Obama-Trump county. I talk to a lot of people here. Is while some of these voters in the middle seem hesitant on Trump, questioning Trump, they're just not buying what the Democrats have at all right now, and it's a brand problem. I'm sure you heard about this. How, I mean, it just seems like there's a big barrier for these folks even to consider Democrats right now. And I'm not sure if it's policy, if it's like a leadership or what. But what are your, I'm sure you found that. What are your, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, that was very much what we found in the groups we did. And we did some more groups early this year. We did some again over the summer. And if anything, the Democrats' problem is as bad as it ever was, if not worse, in that these voters that are swing voters, as I say, are not like diehard for Trump. And they have got some misgivings. And they're particularly worried that he's not sufficiently focused on their top issue, which is cost of living. So they are worried about where things are going, but that is not pushing them towards the Democrats. And it's exactly as you say, Robin, that the brand problem has to be overcome before the party would even get a hearing. And I say that from the point of view of having heard exactly these same statements when Keir Starmer took over leadership of the Labour Party in 2020, and we ran exactly the same kinds of research. And like our voters are just saying, the voters that I think should have been our voters, they had left us for the Conservatives, were just saying, yeah, the Labour Party is for students or the unemployed. It's not for me. It's kind of these, what was seen as sort of a bit tangential issues. Didn't think they represented people like them at all. And all of those are the same things that have come up for the Democrats. So what we learned was, unless we were prepared to say we will change the party in order to gain their trust again, we were never going to get a hearing. And we set out all the ways in which we did that, and Keir really led that with some authority. We never said, oh, the voters are wrong, so let's persuade them why our party is right and they are wrong. We had the respect to say it's us that's got this wrong. And that's painful, and that's really, really difficult for a party to do when you've invested in it. But it was absolutely critical for us to gain a hearing with those voters before they would even hear what our criticism of the current, that the then Conservative government was, or would hear what our positive offer was when we got close to the election.
What is it that, I mean, I think this is the heart of the challenge for the Democrats with working class voters. What is it that triggers these negative feelings with these working class voters? Is it maybe a perception of a leader that they don't like, or are it issues? Is it issues? When you dig deep, what is it that triggers this?
So I think the core of it is identity. I think that they do not feel that the current Democrat Party represents or identifies with them or even likes them. Like, and I say this with some, like, I'm conscious that I'm a Brit talking about a party of a country that I'm not a voter in,
Sure.
but I say it with some passion and meaning because it is what we heard about the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, the previous leader, and it took some time for us to change that perception. And it was just so the issues were important, but it was more that the issues were a symbol of every time we were going on about an issue that seemed tangential to their lives, they're like, their response to that is, you do not get me, you do not stand for me, you are not talking about issues that matter to me. So one of the first things we had to do was make sure that what we were talking about and commenting on as a party were the things that mattered to voters. Before we could even reposition ourselves, we had to be absolutely on their top three or four issues all of the time. We had to really enforce some discipline over the party to ensure that we didn't have lots of members of parliament going off taking different positions on really sensitive issues. So there was a lot of what issues are we talking about before you even get on to kind of what position do you take on those things. So the leader does really matter in terms of them leading the party, but our experience was you had to have the rest of the party fall into line because you cannot have that then undermined by somebody going off and creating another different perception. And at the moment, the Democrat brand is being shaped by whoever it is that is most vocal.
I hear this a lot from Democrats saying, yeah, but we passed under Biden, we passed the infrastructure bill, we ch passed the CHIPS Act, we passed the IRA, all this money going in to help create jobs. A lot of that money went into red state areas. I mean, did that obviously didn't have much impact with these voters. It did with some, but not the key voters that switched over and gave Trump the presidency again.
Yeah, when we've done several rounds of research over the last 2 or 3 years, and it was just very clear, even from quite early on, it wasn't just, and I'm in favour of the kind of investment you need as government. Like, I think it is important that government invests and do that well, do it strategically, but you should invest. But it was very clear that that was not having an impact on voters. And if anything, we found that voters felt that the repetition of all of what you'd call the processes, so the amount of money that was being invested or the amount of legislation, whilst they were hurt, inflation was hurting them, reinforced the perception that actually government spending all that money either on not on my priorities, or that is partly what is contributing to my rising costs. So in a sense, it's more the failure to be able to show how those investments actually matter to people and having a tangible benefit that proved Democrats are so problematic when it came to the last election, and still will if they can't reconcile this part of their political problem.
Thought it was interesting, and I forgot the country, if it was Australia or which, but when the Labor Party got in, you emphasized the importance of getting some kind of quick results, low-hanging fruit, whatever, to kind of help reinstill belief in government again, that it can do something positive for people's lives. Can you clarify that for me, where that was and what the idea was?
Yeah, the Aust it was the in the Australians, and I think they've been in some ways they've j the most successful in that they've just won a second term. They've bucked this sort of anti-incumbency trend where they could have been out. So the Australians have had they haven't had a smooth as path, but they did focus on what we'd call these visible proof points of delivery. So about midway through the last parliament in Australia, the Australian Labor Party were quite down in the polls. They lost the major referendum that they had over there, and it looked like they potentially were on their way out. But they really then regrouped and refocused on the economic issues over the cultural issues, and then ran a campaign that told voters how they were going to be a better offer for the future. So they really focused on these really visible what we'd call proof points. So they had. They knew that urgent care centres, which was a new form of healthcare delivery, were actually quite popular when voters heard about it. So they really maximised on making that a key part of the campaign. The same with sort of energy rebate and the solar panels, those sorts of things that were not, they didn't have hundreds of these things. They had a very small number of tangible things that they could point to. And actually, we did some groups in America when Harris was nominated. And you could almost see that voters were looking for something to validate their initial interest in her as a candidate, but they struggled to point to anything that the Democrats had done in power. And I'm sure that's exasperating for those Democrats who have done, did so much from their point of view. But from the voters' point of view, unless it's really visible and tangible and they can see it and feel it and associate it with the party or politician, it doesn't ever have a political benefit. Someone else will tell your story for you if you don't.
You provide recommendations here. The 10-point plan for success. We're not going to have time to go through all of them, but I'm sure you were there, part of these interviews and all, were struck by some things. What do you think was the most if you could boil these down, the most important two, three, four recommendations for candidates for the party to start bringing these working class voters back in?
Yeah, I mean, I think making that big strategic judgment call that it is those voters that you need, and really sticking to your guns and threading it right way through the party, like having an endless debate about chasing, frankly, college-educated voters in the cities, is all time wasted potentially from actually getting on with delivering a party that works those voters. So making a decision in the first place that you are going to be on the side of working class voters. Having candidates that constantly speak to that and symbolize that. So obviously, ideally, you want candidates from their place that are authentic to that place, and really having them as a strong, trusted people that can carry that message forward. And then I just think having that platform of really clear ideas that speak to how they're going to help those working class voters. Again, you don't necessarily need an enormous prospectus, but you do need key symbols that show how you're going to drive the country's economy in particular in favor of those voters. So having that clarity, I think, is the really key things. And then a lot of the community engagement that a lot of our representatives do just is hugely helpful in reinforcing that the party is back in those communities again, and that being part of the national symbol. So maybe a more bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach.
You've been working on this a long time. Anything surprise you during this research here in the United States? Anything that kind of stood out that you maybe took you by surprise?
I think the thing that took me by surprise was how pervasive this sense of insecurity is. I think I'd studied it been around it for years around, yeah, what we'd call working class voters. But I just think it's drifting upwards and upwards up the income spectrum, where you've got people who really would you'd otherwise consider on pretty okay incomes, feeling this sort of constant sense of worry about the future, and the lack of a political leader from the centre left giving them a plan about where they're going and how they're going to get them there. I was really taken by surprise at how that insecurity and fear is driving support, particularly for the far right in Germany, but potentially elsewhere too. So that was the thing that I think on this round struck me as the development that should be top of mind now.
Final question. I've only got like a minute or two left here. Are you finding the party is receptive to your work? I've heard just, over the years that there's an element of the Democratic Party that really doesn't want to hear this, and doesn't want to change and doesn't want to hear about the problems on cultural issues and just wants to kind of sweep this under the carpet. Hey, Harris almost won. It was really close. Seven states. If she flips three, she could have won. Everything's okay. Are you running into that attitude, or is there people pretty open to receiving the report?
Well, I'm really pleased to say that being part of PPI means that there are many other sort of fellow travellers to PPI's view, which is it's not us, it's not the voters that have got to change, it's the party that's got to change yourself. There's many, many parts of the party which is pushing this argument, and PPI is having a series of regional retreats in states. We've just been in Nevada, we were in Colorado earlier in the year. But I think that is an absolutely critical question. And you're not going to, our experience from Labour showed, you're not going to convert everybody to your view, but you do have to have the stronger argument and the most politically potent one. And I would say without, a shadow of a doubt, this is the prospectus that is more likely to see the Democrats in power. And I hope you do it in a shorter trajectory than we did. We took four election defeats before we really took the medicine.
Well, it's this report is an important contribution to the ongoing debate on the direction of the Democratic Party in the future. The New York City mayor's race, that captures kind of the more center, the more far left, Democratic Socialist approach. I think the PPI study captures the more middle of the road approach for Democrats. And so I think it's an important contribution, and I hope people take a chance and look at it. It's PPI.org is the website, and you can find the study there. Again, it's called Build Back Belief: Why Voters Around the World Lost Faith in Government and How to Win It Back. And one of the co-authors has been my guest today. She's Claire Ainslie. Claire, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.